I'd like, I suppose by way of a little bit of review of yesterday, to read something which I wrote as a result of being in South Africa as and attached to an appendix of the first report I did of my study project. And it's a thing called Public Lies in South Africa. And it says something about the situation as you find it there. What I did was while I was in South Africa, I just kept a running list of lies that people told in public ways. I mean lies that people didn't think were lies. And then I just selected some of them and summarized them. And it's called Public Lies in South Africa. In one sense, the injustice in South Africa is not very different from many other nations of the Third World, or even very different from the United States. But it is the blatant systemization of oppression by constitutional law, and the equally blatant and equally systematic denial that any such laws and oppression exist, that makes daily life in South Africa such an incredible insanity. The following are examples of myths and lies that are published, proliferated, and proclaimed through every official and unofficial media of white South Africa, and they are believed by the vast majority of white South Africans. South Africa is a democracy. We are a democracy, over and over again. There is racial equality in South Africa. Say it over and over again, blatant ways, just there is racial equality in South Africa. There is no racial or economic exploitation in South Africa. Black people in South Africa are satisfied with their condition. They're sort of the primary lies that are constantly said. Then there are lies that rationalize and rationalize racial and economic exploitation. God ordained racial differences. That's said over and over again here, so that's not new. South Africa does more for its black people than any other nation. Blacks in South Africa are better off than in the rest of Africa. South Africa is preserving Christianity by its apartheid system. South Africa is preventing communism by its apartheid system. Elimination of apartheid would be unjust to white people. Elimination of apartheid would be unjust to black people. Apartheid exists for the protection of black people. Apartheid is necessary to prevent war. Black people have all the freedom they can handle. Increased wages would only be spent on alcohol. Then there's a whole set of historical lies that are taught. All of these, by the way, I'm not talking about the sort of, you know, that somebody in a bar room says these things. They're official. All these things I've read so far and will continue to read are officially taught in the schools. And the public education systems is for white people, for white kids, is called the Christian National Education Program. And these are official statements of fact taught within that school system. The Afrikaner people were called by God as the new Israel. White people came to South Africa at the same time as black people. And then there's even a stronger lie about that that's often told. White people came to South Africa before black people. The Afrikaners brought civilization to black barbarians. White people brought peace to South Africa. Colored people were caused by visiting sailors. And then lies about daily reality. White people are in the majority in South Africa. Already, even before the homelands are institutionalized and officially made independent, the white people will say in a very open way, white people are in the majority in South Africa. And they also do that by dividing tribes and dividing across if you subdivide the black people far enough into all different categories. You have 20 categories of black people, all of them less than 6 million, then you can say white people in the majority in South Africa. It's amazing how it's done. Unrest is caused by outside agitators and a few radical students. Doesn't that sound familiar? Detainees commit suicide. Every once in a while, there's every couple of weeks, there's somebody who's been detained under the unjust laws which permit the police to detain, arrest, and hold anyone for any amount of time without any charges. And a tremendous amount of torture and so forth, and goes on. And every couple of weeks, a detainee dies in detention. And they always explain it in terms of suicide. Jumped out of a 10-story building, hung himself, slipped in a bar of soap. Even Stephen Biko, whose story most of us know more than anybody else's death in his murder for months, was claimed that he died by suicide. He banged his head against the wall until he died. There is no tradition of family life in Black African culture. So therefore, the system they have set up of migrant labor so that the men only get to see their families 1 month out of the year is not a violation of their culture. It's done according to their natural cultural needs, and so there's no injustice in it. And then some of those insane, irrational beliefs, these are the ones you hear in bar rooms rather than in the schools. Black people are not like white people. They don't feel like white people do. They don't feel pain. They don't get tired. They don't get wet in the rain. It's amazing. They actually seriously believe. Absolutely seriously believe. Well, I'd like to. I'm sure you've heard from me yesterday, if you were here, and can hear from that I have a very, very strong feelings about the total irrationality and the total unacceptability of the South African system, and that there is no way that it can be improved, that it can only be ended. I have deep feelings about that. I believe that the majority of Black people who are thinking politically about the situation believe that. I believe there is no way that the existing South African system, I think that it's as clear as 2 and 2 equals 4 in base 10, that the South African system cannot be improved and made into a just system. There's no way that Hitler could have been created an acceptable government for the Jews. There is no way that the South African government can create an acceptable government for Black people. What I'd like to say this morning is that I think that our government and our industries and our banks and our churches, for the most part, act as if it is possible for the white government of South Africa to be reformed and to be pressured into creating a government that is acceptable for Black people too. That government is reformable. And I have a very strong, as you'll hear, disagreement about that. You may have some disagreement with me about that, and you're quite welcome to do that, and I'm glad to struggle more with that with you this week at any time. Let me give a few stories and a few facts and figures as I know them, and then we can talk about them. I mentioned yesterday that after a while, I got over my fear of being publicly exposed as a Lutheran pastor and as a person whose field is combating racism in the United States, and I began to do some preaching and some visiting, and most of that was illegally done, because you need a permit to do that, and I would never have gotten a permit to do that. And spent a lot of time, if you're interested in seeing slides this afternoon at 4 o'clock, in the Black communities of South Africa. Visited a lot of schools, which is where most of the resistance exists. Visited a Lutheran high school as an example, and this happened over and over again, that I would be asked to speak to a class or to 6 people or to the teachers or to the whole student body, and I'd speak for 10 minutes and not know whether, a white person speaking to them, I had great fear of that, just whether or not I could begin to communicate in such a short time. And over again had the experience of a 10-minute talk ending up into a 2-3 hour dialogue, and just a splendid kind of thing. As an example, I was taken to a Lutheran high school and in their assembly, and at the end of their assembly, I was introduced and had a chance to talk for 10 minutes. The students just insisted And the teachers didn't fight it, of course, but we sat there. It was the end of the assembly period, going into their lunch period and class period, and they were all just canceled. We sat 200 students in dialogue for two more hours, and it was one of the most exciting times I ever had. And what happened, as I perceived it, then and other times, I had nothing really great to say, but they had not experienced at all, or at least very, very seldom, a white person not defending white domination. They had certainly never before experienced a white person from Europe or the United States who refused to pretend or who didn't get defensive when accused of saying that the United States' first interest was gold and second interest was people. And I didn't deny that, and that was very exciting for them to have somebody who would do that rather than say the opposite was true. They were, of course, interested in the fact that I had a lot of experience in the movements here in the United States and was able to share a little bit, for example, and there's two other people, if any of you are interested in talking about the movement days here in the United States, especially in Chicago, Al and Sarah Pitcher, even more so than I. We spent a lot of time in the civil rights movement, especially in Chicago, working with Dr. King. And they were excited to hear about that. But the two things they wanted to talk about the most was, one, how does a Christian participate in violent revolution? Because they see it coming. They know it's coming. And these high school and university people have that question on their minds. They want to maintain their Christian faith, and they want to participate in what's got to be a coming revolution. And then the second thing that they wanted to talk about, and about our subject for the day, is the United States' support for the white South African government. They know it. They know it's there. They see right through it. And they know that there's a lot of deception going on about that. For example, and let me give an example, I went to Steve Biko's funeral. 20,000 black South Africans gathered on a soccer field. Enough white international spotlight on it so that the South African government couldn't prevent the funeral from taking place. They did prevent by insane, horrible cruelty about 20,000 other people from coming, so that about half the people got there who wanted to. And that's another whole long story I'd be glad to tell sometime. But 20,000 black South Africans got to the funeral of Stephen Biko, and there were about 50 of us who were white who were also there. About half of those 50 who were white that were there were representatives of foreign governments. So the South African government, once the funeral began, had to keep their soldiers and their oppression away. The United States government was there, and there in solidarity with the black people, in solidarity with Stephen Biko. The ambassador from the United States came in his limousine with his flag at half-mast, and that's a traditional thing to do in an ambassadorial car. Andy Young sent a big 10-foot wreath to lay on Steve Biko's funeral. The identification of the United States and the rest of the European and North American nations with the black people was visible there, and black people were excited by it. And what it was only marred by a very, very important thing 24 hours later, which made it a lot of black people just think of it as pure false show. That is, 24 hours later, and Beres Naudé and his wife and I, who went to the funeral together, and he's now under house arrest in South Africa under the ban, and it's about a 24-hour drive to King Williamstown, where the funeral was, from Johannesburg. So we also had a Swedish photographer with a reporter with us, and we had to rush back to Johannesburg because 24 hours later, on September 26th, the funeral was on September 25th of last year, there was another important event taking place that we had to make, that this reporter had to make. The American arm of the new Chamber of Commerce was meeting, and John Forster, the Prime Minister of South Africa, was speaking to it. Now, they were gathered there 500 Americans in resident, most of them in resident in South Africa, all of them representing American banks and corporations in South Africa, all of them representing our major non-governmental investment in South Africa. And they gathered 500 of them in the Carlton Hotel in Johannesburg, and John Foster spoke to them 24 hours after that show of identification with the black people. And John Foster, the Prime Minister of South Africa, spoke for 35 minutes, and he attacked the United States. He attacked international interference with affairs, as was demonstrated in the South in Steve Biko's funeral. He defended the apartheid system and the homeland system and the entire process that was going on in South Africa, and promised those representatives of the United States investment in South Africa that their investments would remain safe and secure so long as that system that he stood for remained intact. He was repeatedly interrupted with applause, and in the end was giving an almost endless standing ovation. Now, that was reported not very largely. As soon as it was found that the contradictions and the black people complaining about it was quickly covered up, but insofar as it was reported in South Africa and in European papers, I don't know about the American papers, I didn't get any report on that, but it was reported, and the contradictions between that and the Steve Biko funeral pointed out, and it represents, I think, for us, our conflict. That we may have in our traditions and in our culture and in the words that describe us, who we are as people from the United States, and in our desires here as individuals, that identification with that funeral. When I was there, that funeral reminded me so much of the many funerals I attended here. But I think that where it really counts, where the real decisions are made about whether the South African government will continue insofar as our aid and assistance is responsible for it, that it's the second meeting that represents where we really are. I think we have to come in touch, place ourselves in touch with the fact that that's not an unusual event either. That the history of the decolonialization of Africa over the last 20 to 30 years and longer, the history of especially European, of all of European colonial people from South Africa and the decolonialization of South Africa has taken place over and over and over again in such a way that while it looks on top as though political independence has been reached, that a neo-colonialistic economic relationship has been maintained, so that the gold and the diamonds and the minerals and the resources of South Africa are still controlled by the European and the American corporations and banks. And that what happens in the process of colonial nations leaving over and over again, as has just happened again in Rhodesia, is that that white people stay in control as long as possible politically, and when it's no longer possible, then the black people that are permitted to take over are those that are still controllable by the white people. And black people take over the job of killing black people that white people once performed. Black people are turned against black people, as happened over and over again, if you can think of the history of the last 30, 40 years. One example is the history of Zaire. And I raise this example simply because you and I have experienced in the news in the last few months about the invasion, with supposedly with Cuban help, of the Katanga rebels into the province of Shaba. I don't know if you remember that, and if you can see the map that says the Republic of Zaire is here and used to be Belgian Congo when Belgium was the colonial here. And the bottom part of Zaire, what used to be called the Katanga province, is now called Shaba province, is the richest mineral area in the whole continent of Africa. The richest mineral area in the whole continent of Africa, and the mineral rights and production and mining and so forth are owned by, controlled by France, companies from France and Belgium. When in, and I don't remember my dates exactly, around 1960 or 61, and you may remember some revelations of about 6 to 8 months ago when it was revealed that that was another place that the CIA was deeply involved in causing unrest. When the Belgian Congo became independent, France and Belgium organized from the outside an attempt to create a Katanga rebellion and to create a separate, a civil war, so that, especially because Zaire, the new nation, was leaning towards the left, or that is not leaning towards the right, it was leaning towards the middle, and afraid that those mineral rights would be nationalized, organized a Katanga rebellion army to try and create civil war and a breakaway and a new nation of Katanga. It was done in such a sloppy way that they didn't get away with it. And the United Nations, and then finally the United States also, came out publicly against that, and the efforts failed, and the Katanga rebels, identifying with Europe and the preservation of those mineral rights for Europe, went into refuge into Angola, which was then still a Portuguese colony. And so they got protection. Then, I hope this doesn't get too complicated in this story. 2 years ago, Angola got its independence finally from Portugal. And in the process, the Katanga rebels, one means or another, got converted to the other side. And in the meantime, this is where our CIA and others came in. The leaders of Zaire that were leaning towards the left were uprooted, and the present very irrational and crazy, almost as crazy as Idi Amin in Uganda, came in to take over and identified with the West again. And so we had control of Katanga province again, and all those mineral rights were coming in. The same rebels that were organized from the right got converted and came crashing back in to take over the Katanga for the left a couple of months ago, and were Europe and the United States ever indignant. Indignant about, because now, you know, they had, you know, were trying to take over. The point is there's a couple of big elephants outside of Africa. And when I was in Africa, very few people made a distinction between the elephants of the first world, the United States and Europe, and the other elephant of the communist world of Russia. There's a couple of elephants trampling around Africa that have first primary interest in the mineral rights and in the labor and in the resources of Africa, and only secondary interest in the people. And the people exist only insofar as they can serve those needs. Yes, we want also to be human towards the people, but human as those people serve those needs. I told this story, and some of you, pardon me if I tell the same story I told last week, who heard it before, but I think it's very relevant in this, because I heard it in the context of Africa about elephants. When the United States and Russia were celebrating a new level of detente in the United Nations, and this was about a year and a half ago, and every time we reach a new level of love between the United States and Russia, they take a morning off or a day off in the United Nations to celebrate it and make self-congratulatory speeches about a new level of detente. And so they were doing that, and everybody was making self-congratulatory speeches, and a representative, a delegate from an African nation, got up and said, on this day of celebrating a new level of detente between the United States and Russia, I also would like to make a speech, but my speech is only two sentences long. The first sentence of my speech is a saying from my people, and it is this: when two elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. And the second sentence of my speech, he said, on this day of a new level of detente and love between the United States and Russia, is another saying from my people: when two elephants make love, the grass still suffers. Well, let me move on back into South Africa and say that, and I really want, I'd like to end up this in about 15 minutes with some very particular kinds of things about what I believe our nation should be doing and what we can be helping our nation and our churches to do. I want to get specific today, not just talking generalities over there. The next 5 years, 10 years, maybe it's already happened, will decide whether or not any change is possible in South Africa without a violent revolution. Maybe it's already been decided. If there is a violent revolution in South Africa, it will be horrible. Most observers of South Africa believe that the only way a violent revolution can be avoided is if our nation and other nations of the West take the right side. That is, stop siding with the white government of South Africa and begin identifying with the struggle of black people for freedom. That the only way that a violent revolution, that the only way that the people of South Africa can have another choice besides to respond in a violent revolution against that government is if we stop supporting the South African government. It is a simple fact that's been well established that the South African government could not survive without outside help, and that it gets most of its outside help from the United States and Europe. And it is also a simple fact that has been well established that we are on the wrong side again. Our rationale for being on that side, that is, and when I'll become clear of what I mean by being on that side. We don't obviously don't proclaim that we're on the side of oppression, but rather we have a rationale in Europe and in the United States predominantly, and that rationale is a belief that the South African government can change, can reform, can be made into a government that's just. I believe that underneath that is our desire to maintain our economic relations, and therefore it has clouded our ability to analyze that. And therefore, we really do sincerely believe that if we're given enough time, if given enough pressure, given enough of luck, we will be able to help the South African government become the kind of government it should be, the present South African government. As I said, I believe that our eyes are clouded by our desire to maintain our economic relationships and rights to the minerals, the gold, the diamonds, and in Namibia, as much as half the supply of uranium in the world that we don't want to lose, and also that we're afraid who else might get it. South African government is very, very successful in putting the fear of communism into the hearts of the West and using that. And as is often happens in our country, but even more so there, any opposition to the South African government is labeled as communistic. Any. And so most of their terrorist, anti-terrorism laws, or most of their laws that are designed to oppress the people and keep them from rebelling are done and called laws like the anti-communist laws. And so to oppose apartheid is communist. All right, I believe it's been well established that the only thing that can be done with that kind of a policy is to improve apartheid, to make apartheid more human, as if that could be done. That is, to make the conditions of people living under apartheid a little better will make them more pacifistic and less able to rebel, and therefore maintain the strength of the basic economic relationships of the apartheid system. And so you might see South Africa in the next year even taking away some of its what they call petty apartheid. Like they'll have some of the toilets open for white and black, some of the buses open for white and black. Already they're beginning to open up the richer restaurants and hotels so rich blacks can use them. So you'll see some of the petty apartheid, some of the parks opened up for white and black. Some of the movement in that direction, which really ends up being a cover for really maintaining the movement towards the main goal of economic goal of creating independent homelands that will make possible for black South Africans no longer to be citizens of South Africa, and to maintain the migrant system of labor so that the laboring forces for maintaining the privilege of white people can be continued. I believe that I heard enough from politically aware black South Africans to be able to say that 99% of politically aware black South Africans find the goal of improving the present system, unacceptable, period. And the longer that effort is maintained, the more it ensures that the black people of South Africa will only have one choice for change, and that is the taking up of violent arms of revolution against the existing violent system that now exists. Okay, I'd like to identify three issues for nation and church in the United States about that. I think, though, I'm going to take about 5 minutes before doing that and give you a chance to react to what I've said already, because I want to change the subject and say, now how does it look from over here? What can we do? What are our issues about relating to church and government in relationship to that issue? So before I get to that, I think I would be kind to you if I gave you a chance to ask questions or debate anything I've said so far about that analysis.
Joe, do you support the violent revolution for the black?
Do I support their having a violent revolution? They're not having one now. They haven't got one to support.
You say it's inevitable.
It is inevitable if we don't take action. If our governments do not change our way of action, we will participate in the causing of violent revolution. It doesn't matter whether we support it or not. That's one way I'd answer it. Second way I'd answer it is to say that I do not support violent revolution, period. I don't support violence, period. I'm a pacifist by philosophy and theology. I'm personally a pacifist. I also, though, believe that it is not my choice as to whether or not a violent revolution will be carried out there. It's the choice of the people of South Africa. When they have, at the present time, my stance on violence is total opposition to the violence of the South African government. If the South African people decide that their only alternative is a violent revolution, I don't think that's mine to either support, to choose for them, to encourage them to do that or not encourage them to do that. I don't know what I'll do when it comes to the time. I'll root for them to win. That's what I'll do. I may be against violence, but if somebody's got to win when the war is on, I know whose side I'm on. I may disapprove of the tactics of violence, but I know whose side I'm on. You know, they're choosing a violent way in opposition to my pacifism will not change sides for me, because I know where the violence primarily comes from and is caused.
Do you feel that Andrew Young has some perception and understanding of the picture as you see it, or what kind of hope do you see for input into the circles of power in the U.S. Of some accurate, helpful information?
Seeing that Andy Young is always on the edge of being fired, I guess it would be a pretty accurate thing to say that I think he goes about as far as he can go without getting fired. My guess about him is that he believes even far more strongly than he says. He limits himself. He stops at the point of saying, of taking away his statements, and he says over and over again, it is in the self-interest of capitalist investors in South Africa to do away with apartheid. That's hard to argue, because the tremendous profits in South Africa are made because of apartheid. But his argument, of course, is that if apartheid isn't stopped, there ain't going to be no South African government in 10 years. And anybody who's continued to support that South African government is not exactly going to be in favor when the new government comes in. And then that includes, that's an important statement also for the church. And so he says, ultimately, it's in the self-interest of investors to fight apartheid. That's about as far as he can go. There's a lot of sources for accurate information in the United States. And I, by anybody who wants it, in our film sessions this afternoon and Friday, as well as any time you meet me, I'll be glad to give resources for receiving what I consider to be far more accurate information than we normally get about South Africa.
Of those 20 million black and colored people over there, what is the educational status of them from the standpoint of how well trained or how big a group is well enough trained to actually run something as complex as the government? Even to run a government poorly takes a whole lot of training.
We should know.
It's an important question. Yeah.
Okay, say they have their revolution in whatever form it takes. How well trained and prepared, or how many people, or what percentage, or how are there going to be enough people well enough trained over there to really be able to take over and really represent the group that had the revolution without outsiders just sort of infiltrating and being it over to the communist world or another part of the world or something like that. That could be a real problem if they don't have anybody who's well enough trained to take over.
It's an incredibly important question. It's difficult to answer because of a lot of, let me say three things about it. One is that it's clearly the goal of every colonial or oppressive government to keep the people, its colonists, incompetent. And the entire educational system that the white government of South Africa has devised for black people is to keep them incompetent. What was called the Bantu education system, now they've changed the name to something, system of plural education. They keep changing the name to make you think they're changing the system. States within it, from its basic design and its in the foreword written to the program of Bantu education, that its purpose is to provide that kind of education necessary for black people to assume their position within society. That's its goal. For that reason, black people generally do not, and for 2 years, for the most part in Soweto, did not go to school and often burnt their schools in the uprisings in June. And people said, they're just spoiling their own thing. They could have gotten some education. But generally, they have a very strong and revolutionary point of view about that, that it's better that getting the best of what they have to offer is to get a messed up mind, and that the best act of education is to refuse it. If you refuse that education, you're the smartest person around. Secondly, they keep killing the best competent potential leaders. Stephen Biko was seen by people from around the world as probably one of the highest possibilities as the future prime minister of South Africa, and he was murdered in a prison. So you're right about asking the question of the difficulty of leadership, because the leadership is constantly thwarted and killed. I think it's probably, on the other hand, wrong for many people. What many people say is to think about the kind of competency that's needed for a new government based on the so-called competency of the present one. No one could be more incompetent at running South Africa than the present ones. So the skills, the values, the ways the South Africa present government has, the present leaders of South Africa could not be more incompetent. So that one of the ways of thinking about that is that the new leaders of the South African government have got to have opposite skills than the present ones do. Now, that doesn't take away the technical skills.
Yeah,
and there's
even in one language, you still have to be able to read.
Lots of things are being developed to deal with that. Lots of things. there are many, many South Africans in exile being trained for future leadership, presently. There are, for example, there has been pardon? Africa, Europe, the United States, Russia, lots of places. In many, many universities throughout the world. There is, for example, supported by the United Nations, a Namibia Institute, has been for some time
just up above in Zambia, just above, just outside the Namibian borders. And the Namibian Institute is primarily developing leadership for the future Namibia, because they won't let it happen inside. They go in exile. They move in tremendous, vast numbers of...
They don't get exit visas or anything.
No, they go into exile. They escape from their country. And they are, unless they come back in through infiltration and illegal means, they are out until independence comes. That makes a lot of problems, of course, the division between the people still in and still out. They will be the ones who organize the guerrilla army and the army, the revolutionary army, if it comes to that. Just as happened in Rhodesia and Namibia.
Well, you can say that Biko was actually killed rather than, you know,
it's been fully demonstrated.
What?
It's been fully demonstrated by inquests, various inquests with it reached a point, it was handled so incompetently by the South African government that they had to, because of international pressure, allow some objective investigation. The inquest was supposedly officially closed about 6 months ago. The South African people didn't know that secretly the South African government had allowed the inquest to go on because of international pressure. About a month ago, there was a story in the front page of the Johannesburg paper that said that yesterday the Stephen Biko inquest was officially closed. And they thought it was, the people of South Africa thought it had been closed 6 months ago. And about 2 weeks later, there was an act of reprimand to the people responsible for his death. A couple of people were demoted. And as a kind of token, tacit acceptance of the fact that there was incompetence or that his death was caused. Obviously, they don't charge anybody with murder. But it's been quick, it's been, yes, it was up autopsy. He had... 18 major wounds caused by others. Three of them were to the head and severe enough to have caused death. I think that's the figure, something like that. I think it's been demonstrated.
Joe, maybe this is not a good time to ask this question, if you don't have time to go into this, but I am very confused. Extremely ignorant, as are most of us in this room, I'm sure, about the various groups in Namibia, particularly right now, that I read about in Time magazine. And I would really appreciate some clarification on SWAPO, that's the one that comes to my mind. Which of these groups are doing well?
Insofar as my ability lets me do that, I'd be glad to do that either at another session or outside. I'm going to have to move on into some things about the international things, but I'd be glad to do that. Just one other thing about the competence of South African people to rule themselves. Two things. One is the long, long traditions of South African peoples able to rule themselves over centuries and centuries before we ever began. More important, maybe for our own experiences, that's exactly what England said about us. Dumb colonists. They're a bunch of ex-prisoners, degenerates, and incapable, incompetent people. They never ruled anything. They're the society's outcast. That's why they're over there. They'll never rule anything. You got your hand up, Eller?
Yeah, I'm interested in your three issues.
I'm coming to that right now. Okay, the three issues in relationship to South American, or rather to American, U.S., United States support of South Africa that are most important are the issues of corporations, corporate investment in South Africa. Second, and I'll come back over these in more detail. Second, the banks and loans to South Africa. And third, a very particular bank called the Export-Import Bank, which is controlled by our legislature. I'm sticking to three predominant economic issues and not the clear political issues, because this is not only economic issues, they're economic issues that are controlled by our political policies of the United States. Corporations, for example, are able to continue to invest blatantly, openly, in the systems of apartheid of South Africa because the United States government continues to provide the protection necessary for it, economically, tax, and so forth. Now, I've participated in a lot of discussions and done a lot of reading. I'm still no expert about it, but I think it can be said pretty generally that the stance of almost all of the corporations of the United States is to be opposed to apartheid and to be working towards more justice inside their corporations, more equal treatment of people inside their corporations. I cannot think of that being more contradictory. I think that is a total contradiction to invest in injustice and say we'll have some better toilets or some better promotion policies, but still to accept the system, you know, that whole economic venture supports. It has had some very, very important people working on the improvement of conditions in corporations. A man, the name of whom some of you must probably know, by the name of Reverend Leon Sullivan, who is a Philadelphia black pastor of, I've forgotten what denomination, Methodist, I believe, who started something in America called, I've forgotten the name of it, Economic Opportunities, EOS, Economic Opportunity Services, I'm sorry. It started about 15 years ago, and it was a means of developing black training for black people by black people in skills in order to advance their abilities to participate in our economic systems. Leon Sullivan has done many, many great things within the United States for the upward mobility of black people in their skills. I think he's totally messed up in South Africa. He went to South Africa. South African black people laugh at him because he never got outside the Holiday Inn in the airport. He never went to Soweto, never went anyplace else. Met with the corporation heads and only a few token black people and developed what is now called the Sullivan Principles, that all U.S. investors, almost all U.S. investors in South Africa, adhere to. And most of them say it was easy for us to sign because we were doing most of them ahead of time, before he ever came. Six principles, all of which have to do with improvement of conditions for black people working in U.S.-based corporations in South Africa. All of whom, listen carefully to the words, have to do with the improvement of conditions that black people are working under, conditions that white people determine and administer. None of them have anything to do with black people's self-determination within those corporations. None of them have anything to do with black power, if you will. None of them have anything to do with the recognition of unions. None of them have anything to do with black people promoted above the level that the South African government permits. South African government doesn't permit black people to be in supervisorial positions over white people. None of them have anything to do with black people have anything to say for themselves what they will be and do. All six principles have to do with the improvement of black conditions while working under white administration and supervision. The European Economic, what do we call it? I always get it mixed up in the languages. EEO, OO, the OEC, the Economic Community, or European Economic Community, what is it? The Common Market, thank you. It goes by OEC or something like that. The Common Market Investment Community has developed other principles, 12 of them I think there are. They have some more goals in terms of giving black people power and recognizing power of black people within their firms. All of them do not challenge, obviously, the principle of investing in apartheid. None of them challenge the principle of investing millions of dollars in corporations that make their profit on the continuing basis of an apartheid system. None of them clearly have reached the point of disinvestment, of removing investment. There's a couple of corporations that have done it. Polaroid is one of them. So there are exceptions. But most of them, the vast majority of them, are thinking, first of all, in terms of the primary principle of transnational corporations, and that is the maximization of profit, and do not question the primary question of investing in South Africa. I'll come back to that when we talk about corporations, but that's where that is at. Banks, because of the pressure and campaigns of many people in the United States, some of the major banks have slightly altered their policies, and I don't want to put that down. Citibank in New York, the second largest bank in the United States, along with Chase Manhattan, which is the second largest. I may have them mixed around. Both of them have changed their policies, Citibank, so that they will no longer make any loans to the government of South Africa, and Chase Manhattan, so that they will seriously review any loans to South Africa.
How about the private and private?
That's the Citibank still has not and will not alter any of its policies in terms of making loans to private investment in South Africa. And Chase Manhattan has said it will review all loans in terms of the apartheid system, but has not given any principles in public as to what principles will be used. That's a very important question, because South Africa, a year and a half ago, re-invoked a law that was passed in World War II, which all of us passed in World War II, which said that during the crisis of World War II, there is no such thing as private corporations. That is that, and we did this in the United States, that any product or resource of our people that is important towards the war effort may be conscripted, may be used at will by the United States government. We did that in wartime. South Africa did that in wartime, and all of us, I guess, just sort of said we won't use that law anymore. South Africa reinvoked it, so that in effect there no longer is distinction between public and private property in South Africa insofar as it's necessary to defend the apartheid system. So anything that our corporations make in South Africa can at any time be taken by South Africa to use, as well as the bank loans. I'm deeply involved, and I think all of us ought to be deeply involved in one way or another in the bank withdrawal movement, that we ought not to keep our funds privately or our churches in banks that are loaning to South Africa, and that we ought to not only withdraw them and put them in banks that aren't loaning to South Africa, but that we ought to publicly state that so that it's a witness to justice. And I'm involved in the campaign, especially in New York City, amongst the Metropolitan New York Synod of the LCA, to help every congregation to make that decision. And we're providing, and the Synod has asked every congregation to form a committee. It's not telling them what to decide, but to form a committee of the council to study the issue and to decide whether or not they should leave their money in the banks that are loaning to South Africa, or that participate in consortium loans. Some banks can say, and they're very deceptive about this, they say, we are not making any loans to South Africa. What they don't say, unless you ask them, is that they are participating in consortium loans, in which their bank is involved with other banks that are making loans to South Africa. I think the bank withdrawal issue is an extremely important one, and we ought to all, at the very least, be asking ourselves whether we ought to be withdrawing the money from our own banks that are loaning to South Africa. I have lots of information about that, and that information I'm making available to people who come to the slide thing this afternoon at 4. I'm also willing to talk to anybody about it at any time, day or night. The third issue is a very special one. It's our export-import bank. It is not a private bank. It is a public bank. It is controlled by Congress, and Congress has refused so far to put limits on, except for military. In 1963, the United States stopped supplying any military arms, military supplies to South Africa, so that it's illegal in the United States to supply any military arms to South Africa. It was already too late. South Africa had already used our help to build up the largest army in South Africa so they could make their own weapons by then.
Well, I have a survey that's done at Yale, and Yale came out with statistics that Texaco, Standard Oil, which are in South Africa, are expected to supply all the military.
Yes, they can still supply the oil to the military. There's no way that they can stop it.
One of the important things, just a very key to understanding the position South Africa is in and how she has really just boggled the minds of everybody and deceived everybody and has got us still in her side to defend communism or whatever. South Africa has managed to develop almost every area of survival so that if tomorrow the whole world said we ain't going to participate in your system anymore, she could probably still go on 5 to 8 years before going bankrupt. Except for oil. South Africa has no oil. We're worried about we have only 40% of our oil. She has none. And she couldn't, except for the fact that rumor has it at least, that almost all the empty gold mine shafts are now filled with oil for resources, that she could go on for 3 years with the resources she's built up, but that she could not go on without oil. We keep her alive. It's not that we need to kill her, if you will. We're using the same thing the doctors use for a patient that should have died long ago. We're using, what do they call that then? Well, we're using a life support system to keep alive a dead instrument. I talked too long. I wanted more discussion on that. Tomorrow at 10:30 rather than at 9:15, we'll be on with South Africa again. And I want to talk about the church in South Africa and the church here and our participation as representatives of Christ in this struggle.